For millions of people, it's hard to imagine life without a smartphone, one that lets you call friends, search the web, and know the time of day. Having a phone in the palm of your hand means, among other things, less need to look at your wrist to see if you're running late. But Kayomi Getz reports that the watch industry isn't dying, it's adapting.
It's after 5 in Manhattan's busy Soho shopping district. Monica Espedia is in a rush looking for a watch. It's unusual because the 38-year-old never wears one.
To be honest with you, it's been years, probably 10 years. Since I've had a cell phone, I pretty much stopped wearing watches. And then I just realized last time I was on vacation that I didn't know what time it was.
Expedia's upcoming trip to Bali is the only reason she's breaking down now. And she's not been alone in having a bare wrist. Since 2005, the number of people buying watches has declined by millions. Meanwhile, nearly every adult has now acquired a cell phone, about 92%, according to research firm Experian Simmons. Yet walk into any American Apparel retail store. There, alongside pastel-colored hoodies and boyfriend shorts, are rows and rows of watches. Casio calculator styles, prim and simple, or gold and bold. At one store on the Lower East Side, there were at least 5 different displays.
The small faces, the simple one with the black bands, is really popular.
Up until a few years ago, American Apparel didn't even sell watches. But the company struggled in recent years and was willing to experiment. So they tested with a few colorful novelty watches from decades ago.
People flipped out when they saw them.
Creative director Marcia Brady says they soon realized their tech-crazy customers craved something else, a sense of nostalgia. Many of the styles for sale are no longer in production, but they reminded 20-somethings of styles they saw as a kid.
One of the most popular things that we hear when people are looking at the watches is, oh my God, I used to have that watch. And I think that's what draws people in initially. Vintage is a very big part of our aesthetic.
Last year, the company sold 84,000 of them, the same year the iPhone released its latest version. This year, Brady says they expect watch sales to climb 30% higher. Max Kilger is an analyst for Experian Simmons, a firm that tracks consumer behavior. He says retailers are finding there's still a market for watches, if they understand why.
With the increase in smartphone usage, it's caused the watch industry to sort of shift away from more utilitarian watches, which are less in demand now, and more towards fashion statement watches.
In other words, people even in their 20s and 30s are buying watches, just not to tell time. They're people who use fashion to project their tastes, be it classic, retro, or street style. Using a watch as a statement piece has always been true with the luxury market, and today that's booming too. Just this month, auction house Sotheby's brought in its second highest watch sale ever, nearly $13 million. Back at American Apparel, 21-year-old fashion student Taylor Trentini says she always wears her big, gold-plated watch.
Yeah, it's very much so a fashion thing, I think, but it's just habit for me now. If I'm not wearing it, I feel lost.
And she even uses it to check the time, once in a while. For NPR News, I'm Kayomi Getz in New York.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We live in a networked world. Our banking, transportation, power, and water systems all depend on computer operations. An attack on the U.S. in cyberspace could bring a halt to normal life here.
So far, the countries with the greatest cyber capabilities, China and Russia, have little reason to hurt us this way. But soon, there may be another country to worry about.
NPR's Tom Gelton reports on the cyber threat from Iran.
The United States and its allies have brought tremendous pressure on Iran to give up any thought of developing a nuclear weapon. Israel says military action may be needed to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities. If that happens, the Iranians may want to retaliate. They could sponsor terrorist attacks, or they could go to their computers and wage a cyber war. Security expert Dmitry Alperovich says the Iranians' capabilities should not be underestimated.
There is a great deal of worry in terms of what they may be able to do if they're pushed to the brink. And certainly if they believe the regime is threatened, if they believe they're about to be attacked, how can they employ cyber weapons to either deter that attack or to retaliate in a way that they can't do militarily.
Iran until now has not been considered a big threat in the cyber domain, but that is changing, says consultant Jeffrey Carr.
They have all the resources and the capabilities necessary to be a major player in terms of cyber warfare.
In testimony earlier this year, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said Iran's cyber capabilities have dramatically increased in recent years. Iranian authorities, for example, have organized a cyber army and made use of so-called patriotic hackers to suppress dissident communications, shut down Twitter, and block websites. Jeffrey Carr, author of Inside Cyber Warfare, says these are not easy things to do.
If the Iranian hackers have demonstrated, you know, a better than average capability, then it's only common sense to assume that the Iranian government is at least as good and probably better. They certainly have the money, they have the desire, and they have access to some of the best schools around the world to train their engineers.
The big fear in the U.S. is that a cyber attacker could penetrate the computer system that controls a critical asset like the power grid and shut it down. If Iran were caught doing that, it could find itself in a cyber war with the U.S. military. That would probably be a losing proposition. But there is an alternative. Retired Marine General James Cartwright, the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, thinks Iran could share its cyber weapons with a group more willing to use them and less vulnerable to counterattack.
A country could take an offensive capability and easily hand it to somebody that has the intent to use it as a sword rather than a shield. Okay? That's what people worry about, both in cyber and nuclear. In cyber, it's much easier. I mean, I'll just, you know, email it to you, whatever, and say, okay, hey, I know you don't like the Americans. Here's a tool.
The obvious candidate is Hezbollah, the Islamist group that has conducted operations around the world, often in support of Iran. U.S. officials say Hezbollah has shown interest in developing its own cyber arsenal. On Capitol Hill today, a Homeland Security subcommittee will hear testimony on the Iranians' potential to sponsor cyber attacks against the U.S. homeland. Representative Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania is the chairman.
We know that they will do something if they feel cornered. We know that they have a capacity, and I think it's realistic to try to be assessing the scope of that.
U.S. intelligence officials decline additional comment on the Iranian cyber threat. John Brennan, the White House counterterrorism advisor, says only that when a country has both the capability and intent to launch a cyber attack against the United States, everything possible must be done to prevent that attack from taking place. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
Up next, it's the stuff of science fiction, spacefaring robots chipping away at nearby asteroids to extract trillions of dollars worth of precious metal. One company announced this week that it hopes to turn the idea into reality. The venture, Planetary Resources, backed by filmmaker James Cameron and a group of billionaire investors, including Google's Larry Page and Eric Schmidt. They plan to expand the world's natural resources by mining near Earth asteroids. Eric Anderson is the chairman and the CEO of a private space exploration company, Space Adventures, also co-chair and co-founder of Planetary Resources. He calls himself an asteroid miner. He joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday.
How are you, Ira?
You have that miner's hat on with the light on in the front?
I don't. Right now I'm behind a computer looking at astrodynamical orbits and other sorts of prospecting data as we begin our search for the near-Earth asteroids that are going to be the most valuable for our missions.
I mean, this has got to be an expensive venture. Can you really make money on pulling in the asteroids and mining them?
I believe so. We wouldn't have started the company otherwise, but, you know, it is an expensive venture in the long term, but so is every other resource-intensive and extraction effort. I mean, these kinds of projects are over the lifetime of terrestrial mines and, you know, gas finds or oil finds and things like that. They're measured in decades, and they're measured in billions of dollars. And I think that ultimately, to get the kind of resources out of space that will really make a dent in global GDP, you're going to have the same number.
And you say these are like the low-hanging fruit of the solar system.
Well, there's no doubt about that. So the near-Earth asteroids number about 500,000, but we only know of 9,000. And the reason that they're so interesting, Ira, is because they are actually energetically easier to reach than the surface of the moon. So we've been to the moon many times, and the moon is a great place, which is very worthy of our exploration. But just to give you an idea of how close some of the asteroids are, they are easier to reach than our own moon.
Yeah.
So they're not way out there in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. These are,
right.
These are near-Earth objects, and they are very, very useful.
Yeah. What kind of metal? You're looking for platinum, gold? What's the holy grail here?
Well, there's different types of asteroids, and each type has a different concentration of different types of elements. So a certain type of asteroid is very high in nickel and iron. Those are useful ultimately. Another type is very high in water, which is extremely useful. Other volatiles as well, things like methane, which you'd know better as natural gas.
Well, let me stop you there for a minute, because we have plenty of water on this planet. I mean, do we have to go to an asteroid to mine it?
Well, the water that we would get off of asteroids would not be brought back to Earth. That would be used to drive an economy in space. So the great expense of going to the asteroids and going to the moon and other planets is, of course, the fact that it takes a lot of rocket fuel, and the fuel we have to bring from the surface of the Earth. So if we can actually source our fuel in space, it makes literally the roadways open for the rest of the solar system.
Oh, so these are like little fill-up stations, then.
We call them propellant depots, but yes, in layman's terms, it's a gas station. And for, let's not forget that water is comprised of two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen, and hydrogen and oxygen together form the best propellant fuel combination that we know of.
Yeah.
It's what powered the space shuttle.
Right.
And if you take, just to give you an idea of the scope, if you take a 50-meter asteroid, of which there are literally thousands, that is rich in water, that has enough water on it, enough ice, to have launched every single space shuttle that ever launched in the history of the space shuttle program.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Eric Anderson, co-chair and co-founder of Planetary Resources. Those things would be very valuable, as you say, for space fuel. Added to the, on top of that, the asteroids might have valuable minerals that you can mine on them.
Well, there's no question about that. So I've studied at length the resources, the various elements that we have on Earth and their abundances and their scarcity and their, the peak point that we project that we're going to be able to pull them out of our various terrestrial mines and what our reserves are. And you'd actually be shocked to see, when you really look at it, the number of different elements that are, we have only decades left, some short number of decades and others longer numbers of decades. But in my mind, to drive the prosperity of the future, if we want our children and really our children's children and their children to have the same level of prosperity that we in the West have, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that we're going to need to bring resources from space and add them to our economic base in order to allow that prosperity. It's not like we can't live without resources from space 100 years from now, but it means that we're going to be fighting over them a lot more than we are now.
Is that the timeline you're talking about, 100 years, or what is...
Well, that's the timeline I think that would be fair to talk about in terms of bringing mass resources, like, you know, millions and millions of tons per year. But I think even on a scale of 10 years or 15 years, we could certainly be bringing back the most valuable resources, and that brings me to my point before, which was that the platinum group metals right now are thousands of dollars per ounce. I think platinum itself is $1,500 an ounce, and there are other platinum group metals that are more and others that are less. And these are really expensive metals. I mean, all of the platinum that's ever been mined in history would fit into a small box in the middle of a room, okay, so maybe 2 or 3 cubic meters. And yet it exists in these very high quantities in certain types of asteroids.
But wouldn't you be driving down the price of platinum if you start bringing it back to Earth?
I tell you, Ira, nothing would make me happier.
Is that right?
The story of aluminum, it's a really interesting one. If you go and look it up,
yeah.
Even though aluminum is 10% of our Earth's crust, we could never get to it until the 18th century because it was in oxides and we didn't know how to get it. And so back in the day of Napoleon's court, when he had his most VIP guests, he would pull out the aluminum and leave the gold and silver for the nobles. And then we figured out how to pull aluminum out of its oxides, and now we use it everywhere. And platinum group metals are no different. They're very useful in electronics, microprocessors, medical devices, you name it, catalytic converters, renewable energy. And I would love to see a day, whenever that may be, when the platinum group metals are 100 times cheaper than they are now.
I'm reminded of a Twilight Zone adventure where they learned how to make gold and it was worthless. That's another story. But take us through the steps for your planned stage. Where do we go from here, and what are the steps?
Well, it's a three-phase plan. First of all, we have a technology roadmap that we've developed that lists every bit and every piece of technology that we need in order to go and extract resources from asteroids. We have some of that technology today and others we need to develop, and so we're slowly but surely piecing together and pulling together all the different pieces of technology that we need to have. Number two, we're going to do asteroid prospecting. And so this means that first we're going to develop a series of Arcad 100 spacecraft to go into low Earth orbit and study the near-Earth asteroids and make sure that we found lots of the other interesting ones that are not yet found and look closer at the ones that we do know of.
And number three?
Well, part of number two is to go and send swarms of Arcad 300 spacecraft to these high targets, high-value targets. And then after number two, we'll choose the ones that we want to actually extract resources from. And then number three, phase three comes along, which is to go and extract those resources and deliver them to the point of need.
Good luck to you, Eric Anderson. I hope you get a webcam on those asteroids for us to follow along with you.
We will. Don't worry.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Up now is Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got for us today?
We're checking back in on a fan favorite.
Ooh.
This week. It's the Robofish, part deux. when we last left. This is an amazing story. So we visited a lab at Polytechnic Institute of NYU, and it's a mechanical engineer, Maurizio Porfiri's lab. And a couple years ago, he shared with us this amazing video of his robotic fish swimming around a tank with little giant danios following it around, milling about the robot as it swam around. And this, this sort of blew my mind. It combines two of my favorite things, robots and fish. So I immediately loved it.
It's a Pied Piper fish, right?
Absolutely. And when we did that video, which you can see on our website, he was sort of still trying to figure out just why the real fish followed this robotic leader. So here we are a few years later, and he has some insights into what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And what he found out is that it has to do with the tail flapping. So basically, and he designed this tail. This is not like a coincidence. I mean, he designed the tail of the robot so that it moves water like a real fish would. And what he did is set up an experiment in his lab in this long water tunnel. And you have water kind of cycling through.
Right.
And you put the robot in, and then you put a real fish in. And you see if you change the tail flapping, what does the real fish do? And it turns out if you flap the tail at certain rates, at certain water flows, the fish always positions itself, or most of the fish position themselves, in this particular spot right behind and to the side of the robot. And anyone who's seen, like, Tour de France or race car
NASCAR,
driving. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Know what's going on here. The fish is drafting. Basically.
In the water, the currents are set up to like pull you along. So you the other fish position themselves behind the robot fish.
Yeah.
They draft the fish.
They draft the fish. It's a hydrodynamic advantage. And
it's
the question is here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he actually has like a laser set up, and you can watch the flow in slow motion of the particles. So you can see these little swirls of water being sent in the fish's direction. And they think that this is helping propel it. So the interesting thing is, you see that in the water tunnel, but what does that mean for fish schooling and for this robotic fish? And he thinks that, maybe some of this behavior has to do with this hydrodynamic advantage, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. So by schooling, they're actually helping themselves swim.
Right.
The most efficient way.
Right. So the ones in the back may get an advantage by swimming behind a fish, but they, pay the cost of not getting to food first. They also are safer because they don't get eaten first if a predator is coming right at them. So it's a complicated issue, and he's just looking at this one little piece, but
it's fascinating. The video is, I call it the Pied Piper fish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Robofish and friends. It's a great little video up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week, and
And you can see this following, the milling about of the robots. One thing that he said that was really interesting to me is, you know, not every fish will follow. And so his next installment, so stay tuned, this could be number three in a few years, is to figure out how personality drives sort of the differences between the fish. It seems that the bolder fish are less apt to follow the robotic fish.
Yeah, they go their own way.
They go their own way, exactly.
Start their own drift.
Exactly.
And then, you know, they go in circles just like NASCAR. No. There it is. Up on a video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
And it's up there at sciencefriday.com. And also you can download it on your iTunes and also on your iPod. Take it with you. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Maleski. As I say, if you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. We have our iPhone and Android apps that will download our videos and put you in touch with the rest of the Science Friday community. And we'll be discussing stuff all week long on Twitter at SciFry and on our Facebook page /SciFry, where stuff's happening all the time. And you can see the videos up there also. You can send us mail the old-fashioned way to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Sorry, I have to say it that way, being a New Yorker. And you can talk about it all week long. Have a great week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
From cyber surveillance to airport surveillance now, and the issue of racial and religious profiling. Some religious and minority groups say they are unfairly singled out for more extensive screening in the security line. And as NPR's Tasneem Shama reports now, civil rights groups led by the Sikh Coalition think they have found a solution in smartphones.
It's called FlyRights. It's a mobile app, and here's how it works. Travelers who suspect they've been profiled take out their phone, tap a finger on the app, and answer about a dozen questions. Then they hit submit, and this immediately files an official complaint with the Transportation Security Administration, known as the TSA. Amardeep Singh is co-founder of the Sikh Coalition. He says the idea for the app came from Sikh entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who felt they were being stopped unfairly at airports.
They literally said to one of our staff members, there should be an app for that. We thought, great idea, let's start working on it.
Many men wear dastars, or turbans, to cover their kesh, or uncut hair. Hardayal Singh, no relation to Amardeep, is the director of United Sikhs, a human rights advocacy group. Most Sikh men share the name of Singh, and women use Kaur, spelled K-A-U-R. Hardayal has a long black beard and wears a dark olive turban. He says the turban is meant to serve as a symbol of equality and justice. But at airports, he says, turbans lead to extra scrutiny.
You go to the airport, you know that you're going to be pulled aside, you know that your turban is going to be asked to be touched upon, and then, of course, you don't want to take that option. And then, you know, the way the x-rays are going to be flowing in to see if you're a safe traveler or not.
Hansdeep Singh recently co-founded the International Center for Advocates Against Discrimination with Jaspreet Singh. He explained the screening process at airports for turban-wearing Sikhs. First, there's the metal detector. Then, an explosive trace detection pat-down. An officer or the passenger touches the turban and swabs it. The paper swab is then analyzed. If there are no traces of explosives, the traveler is free to go. If there are still questions, the passenger could be asked to remove his turban for further inspection, which Hansdeep calls the greatest insult. Lastly, there's the metal hand wand. And in some cases, the advanced imaging technology machine.
Instead of these policies getting better, they've gotten actually more extreme. So we had two levels of screening, now we're at three levels of screening. So there's literally no way, no policy or screening method for us to go through that doesn't literally strip us of our dignity each time.
At Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C., TSA spokesman Kavika Riley says there's no religious profiling, just screening for safety.
If a passenger is wearing any type of bulky headwear, they may be subject to additional screening. We do not profile based on race. We do not profile based on ethnicity. We do not profile based on religion.
It's not only Sikhs who face extra scrutiny. Across cultures, there are travelers who wear head wraps or bulky clothing and say they get similar treatment. Riley says the TSA must try to detect ever more sophisticated weapons, plastic explosives, for instance, that can't be seen on x-rays. But he says the agency doesn't want to mistreat flyers.
We're constantly working to improve our detection technology, our officers' training, and TSA's capacity to make the travel experience not just more secure, although that's our focus, but also more convenient for passengers.
Amardeep of the Sikh Coalition says he hopes the app, which has been tested with the TSA, will encourage more people to file complaints so that there is more accurate data on improper screening. Flyrights will be available for download starting Monday. For NPR News, I'm Tasneem Shama.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, a new privacy system called Do Not Track. America's big tech companies are negotiating the details of the plan that would let people shield their personal data from websites. There's no deal yet, but privacy advocates inside the talks say one thing is striking. Every compromise is being weighed with Europe in mind. NPR's Martin Kosty reports.
Jacob Konstam is a European privacy regulator. He's been on a tour of Silicon Valley, and his message to America's tech giants is respect European privacy rules, or else.
Enforcement actions against them will be taken.
Not only should people be allowed to block websites from collecting and keeping their data, he says, that should be the default setting, on European browsers at least. Talking from a phone inside the headquarters of Facebook, Konstam is in no mood to let Americans decide everything about the Internet.
To say American companies rule this world could be a very dangerous sort of thinking.
American companies are feeling the heat. Stu Ingus is a lawyer for the Digital Advertising Alliance.
I can tell you, as somebody who's around these companies every day, that they're creating untold benefits to both our economy and to consumers. And it'd be a shame if the Europeans want to limit those benefits.
That argument plays well in D.C., where politicians don't want to be accused of killing jobs or hampering innovation. The attitude is more adversarial in Brussels. Take this public service video produced by the European Commission. It shows people happily surfing the web, buying things online, but when they hit enter, their clothes fly off. It's hard to imagine the U.S. government making an ad like that.
The European approach to privacy is that it's potentially a very unequal relationship.
Chris Doxey is director of the European Data Protection Authority, though he says these are his personal opinions, not those of his office. He says Americans regard online privacy as take it or leave it. If you want, say, Gmail, you have no choice but to click I accept.
Whereas in Europe, your consent has to be real and informed, and there mustn't be a disequilibrium. If there is, then the consent may be incapable of being given.
Earlier this year, EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding announced new privacy legislation, which would impose hefty fines on rule breakers. And she also said this.
And it will make Europe the worldwide standard setter for a digital market and for data protection.
That's the last thing American companies want, especially in a global data collection industry, which they dominate, at least for now. If European rules become the global standard, says privacy law expert Jane Wynn, then European companies may not be far behind.
If somebody can seize control of global arenas, then their domestic industry gets a leg up, because they only have to cope with one system.
Wynn says Europeans have sincere cultural reasons for their tougher privacy rules, but they're also not opposed to gumming up the Americans' business model online, which trades free services for users' personal data.
The American companies feel an entitlement to collect this information, and so culturally, it's hard for them to shift gears.
The cheap data fueling American tech companies is sometimes compared to the cheap gasoline that used to fuel the American auto industry. Like Detroit, the argument goes, Silicon Valley is not likely to change its business model until it's forced to by events outside the U.S. Martin Kosty, NPR News.